A manager in Broadcasting House, Matilda Macari.
Get thinking about the cultural world around us.
Post-pandemic, we've all, every single one of us, been reminded about the value of culture to our lives.
Issues at home and abroad.
There is a strong anti-music sentiment. We've seen videos, for example, where musical instruments are smashed.
And take a deeper look into music making itself.
The thing about Sibelius, as with any composer, that it really is a language which one has to learn in order to speak that music.
All that on Music Matters, where next weekend we'll be discussing how we hear the works of Vaughan Williams now.
Music Matters, Saturday mornings at 11:45 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's just after midday and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest is the late children's author and illustrator Shirley Hughes, who died in February at the age of 94. The programme was originally broadcast in 2017.
Shirley Hughes is the creator of many of our best-loved and most enduring children's books, having written more than 70 and illustrated over 200. Her picture books have an enduring appeal with their sympathetic but unsentimental depiction of the small dramas and joys of family life. One of her most loved, Dogger, the tale of a beloved toy dog lost and found, has its 40th anniversary this year, and Shirley herself is in the midst of celebrating her 90th birthday. The winner of numerous awards, she recently received a CBE for services to literature. I know you're still working, Shirley, and the heart of your work is your sketchbook, I imagine.
Oh, yes. My sketchbook's terribly important because I can't use a camera. I'm a rotten photographer. In fact, I haven't got a camera. And I go out with a sketchbook and lurk about in sort of parks and play areas and places.
Lurking with intent, but good intent.
With good intent. And you get to observe, particularly children, the way they jump up, or they all crouch down together and look at something, or they go off like a flock of birds, you know. And I think that is your memory training. And that's how, when I get to my drawing board, I can get Alfie's expression, the way his feet go when he's a bit nervous, or his hands and his clenched up or whatever. And I've got all that from my sketchbook, because it's in my memory, it's in my head.
I suppose your sketchbook is like a visual diary. You take it for travelling.
Oh, absolutely. We've been on some marvellous holidays to Italy, and luckily there, where the sun shines, people aren't so worried if you try and draw them. It is an intrusion to draw people, I suppose. But there, they're very busy in the evening enjoying themselves. They didn't seem to mind that I was drawing them.
Does the act of drawing, do you think, make us look at the world in a rather different way?
Yes. I really wouldn't know. I don't know what it's like not drawing.
And do you think that music has something of a similar effect?
I didn't have a very good musical education, really. I learned the piano, piano lessons, and I couldn't stand the pieces I was given.
Some of them are awfully banal, aren't they?
Oh, dear, yes. It was sort of fairies on the grass. And I didn't practice from 1 week to the end. And so this was very disheartening for my teacher as well as for me. So in the end, I gave that up.
Well, judging by this first piece, you've certainly broadened your horizons since, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Because this is something you heard quite recently at a neighbour's house, I think. Scriabin.
Yes. This neighbour of ours asked me, over just for quite an evening with a few friends, and she said there was going to be a pianist there to play, and they do have a very good piano. So I went there and we sat around, and how amazing when in walked Dmitri Alexei. It was wonderful. It was marvellous, you know. There was this man who, you know, played in all the great concert halls all over the world, and he was such a quiet and delightful man. And he played this piece, which I had never heard before. And it was an absolute revelation. he played with such wonderful sense of light and shade, a sort of fluidity and beautifully articulated. I'll never forget it.
We're very lucky because he has recorded it, so we can recreate the experience for you now.
Thank you.
Dmitri Alexeyev performing the first movement of Scriabin's Piano Sonata No. 3 in F-sharp minor. Your father died, Shirley Hughes, when you were 5, and then the war came when you were 12, so it doesn't sound like a terribly easy childhood.
No, well, it wasn't. One of the things, of course, that you couldn't do was go anywhere. Hitler's Luftwaffe was bombing Liverpool docks on a nightly basis when I was a child, and we were in the Wirral, which is a sort of suburban area quite close to Liverpool. We didn't get bombed, but we were very aware of the Blitz. You didn't go there at night, so you couldn't go out at night.
So what did you do as a child to entertain yourself?
Well, we read. I used to love comics, and in those days the English comics were little sort of rather gentle little things about Mrs. Bruin and the Bruin boys. But then there was this amazing moment when the GIs arrived in Liverpool, and with them came, I don't know whether it was ballast or what, but it came the American funnies. And they were, of course, comics designed for adults. And so they were very sophisticated. It was Blondie and Dagwood and Popeye. And that had a huge influence on me.
Was there music in your childhood?
No, not really. I think we must have had a wind-up. No, very bad musical education. We listened to the radio. We listened to the big bands. We listened to, Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and those sort of bands on the radio. But I think I got onto it because we had this wonderful breakthrough one evening. We were sitting around, we were sitting around in somebody's house and it was very quiet. You could hear a pin drop in West Kirby on a Sunday. There's nothing doing whatsoever. And a boy who was a clever chap, Donald, he was working for a scholarship at the local grammar school, and he said he didn't think much of this stuff we were listening to. And, he said, "No, you want to listen to this?" And he stubbed out his Woodbine cigarette and out, and got this onto his wind-up gramophone. He put this record, which he'd probably bought second-hand in Birkenhead Market or somewhere, and out of it came this amazing voice, and it was Billie Holiday, and she was singing "I Must Have That Man," lovingly, coaxed along by Lester Young on his tenor saxophone, and it was amazing, that kind of singing I hadn't heard it before.
It won't ever mend. I ain't much caring, just where it will live. But I must have that man. I'm like an oven that's crying for heat. He treats me awful each time that we meet. It's just unlawful how that boy can cheat, but I must have that man. He's hot as Hades, ladies, not safe in his arms when she's kissed. And I'm afraid when he's cooled off, maybe I'm ruled off his lips. I'll never be missed. I need that person much worse than just bad. I'm half alive and he's driving me mad. He's only human if he's to be had. He's hot as Hades, ladies. is not safe in his arms when she's kissed. And I'm afraid when he's cooled off, maybe I'm ruled off his lips. I'll never be missed. I need that person much worse than just bad. I'm half alive and he's driving me mad. He's only human if he's to be had. I must have that man.
Billie Holiday with I Must Have That Man. Shelley Hughes, you said in your autobiographical book, A Life Drawing, that childhood was quite boring when you were growing up, but you had lots of time to play and think, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I think possibly that children, if there's anything wrong with children, have a much more exciting childhood, but I do think they're overstimulated. The danger is that they're always, always something on hand and you can get to it very quickly. I think boredom is a very boredom or empty time, not necessarily boring, but is a very, very good idea.
Do you worry that we live in an era of sort of instant gratification? Which means that the mind is perhaps not working as much as it might if we had to think up things to entertain ourselves.
Yes, I think it's terribly important. I think learning how to look, is a skill. You don't just flick through things. You look very carefully, and very, very small children have the experience of turning the page and what's going to happen next and looking at the detail. And it's not a competition. Reading or looking. It's a pleasure, but you just need to develop it. And I think it's a great challenge.
And just as hearing an instrument in a room, the live instrument,
yes,
is exciting, so the physical object of a book.
Oh, yes. I meet a lot of parents, and it's all sort of, he can read this and he can read that, she can do this. It doesn't really matter. I mean, I was a fairly slow reader. But the important thing is with picture books is that they are learning how to look at and not something that isn't moving.
Another song now, but of a rather different hue. We heard Billie Holiday earlier, and now we're going to hear music by Schubert.
Yes. Well, I was very lucky to hear Paul Lewis, a pianist, play at the Wigmore Hall, and I didn't really know anything about him. I was absolutely knocked out by his playing. It was so accessible. It was lovely playing. And I believe he is somebody, this may not be true, but I think it is, that didn't get hothoused from a very, very early age in music. And that he rather found it for himself. He used to borrow records from the public library and go home and listen to them, And then, of course, it was realised what a good musician he was, and he blossomed from there.
And he has a partnership, doesn't he, with a wonderful tenor?
Yes, Mark Padmore.
Who you also heard?
Yes, and I heard them with this lovely The Winterizer. And I thought it was beautiful. It was a great privilege to have heard that.
Und
I think Mark Padmore would be very pleased, Shirley Hughes, that you began that introduction by talking about the pianist, because as we heard, it's quite a demanding part, isn't it, the piano role there?
Yes, yes.
And pianists are often, when they're talked about as accompanists, as though they're some lesser figure, but as Mark Padmore said on this programme recently, it's a partnership.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, we heard Der Lindenbaum, the Linden Tree, from Schubert's Winterreise, and the pianist was Paul Lewis. Now, I think you went to art school in Liverpool.
Yes.
Just after the war, and then to the Ruskin School of Drawing in Oxford.
Yes.
That must have been rather wonderful.
Yes, I learned a lot at Liverpool, I have to say, in that early years, because I thought I wanted, at that point, to design costumes for the stage. So we learnt how to cut clothes, you know, how to make our own dress patterns, and a lot of history of costume, which is terribly useful when it comes to illustration, because I don't just illustrate my own books. I earned a living for a long time illustrating other people's books and fairy tales and so on, and getting people into costume in the right way, the way it influences the way people stand, you know, the way people look. And that was all terribly useful.
One always thinks of art school as somehow bohemian, was it?
Well, Liverpool wasn't. I was living at home. You know, I was considered too young to be living away. Then I got to the Ruskin, and there were a lot of young men coming back from the war at that time. And they were older, and they were very committed to getting on with their lives, you know, having been in the forces. The girls were out, you know, numbered by these chaps, and so there was a lot of being, you know, dancing and all that stuff. But I did love doing the illustration bit of the course, and that was straight drawing, you know, and so on. I think I learnt probably more in my first year at Liverpool than I learnt at the Ruskin. But I did do an awful lot of life drawing, and that, of course, is always a good basis for any kind of illustration. I also learnt lithography. I learnt how to do colour separations. And just at the very end, there was a very grand lithographer illustrator called Barnett Friedman, who came as a visiting tutor. He thought we were all a lot of silly girls, rightly so. But he did say just at the end, when we were leaving, we graduated, he said, and you, by the way, if you really work at it, you could probably be an illustrator. And if you like, you can come and see me in London and I'll give you an introduction. And he was as good as his word, and he gave me an introduction to Billy Collins, and I got my first book to illustrate. And I was a working illustrator for a long time before I started my own books.
Yes, you worked, you provided illustrations for Alison Utley, Noel Strathfield, Dorothy Edwards. Oh, in fact, drawings of her Naughty Little Sister books were an instant hit, weren't they?
They were mobs. Yeah, that was wonderful, having Dorothy. She'd had other illustrators. She asked if I would illustrate her books. So that was a terrific breakthrough for me, yeah.
It must have been quite a responsibility, in a sense, to illustrate other people's work, because at least when you do your own, you're your own boss, aren't you?
Yes, yes. I often think it must be awful to write a story about a little girl and Dorothy had a picture in her head, and then seeing my picture might not have at all been OK, but it was. She liked it and we got on very well.
Then in 1960s, you say, you started writing your own picture books, and one of my favourite characters is that little boy called Alfie. And I was going to ask you if you'd be very kind to transport us back to being very young and read the beginning of the first Alfie story, Alfie Gets In First.
Right. One day, Alfie and Mum and Annie Rose were coming home from the shops. Alfie ran on ahead because he wanted to get home first. He ran all the way from the corner to the front gate and up to the steps to the front door. Then he sat down on a top step and waited for the others. Along came Mum, pushing Annie Rose and the shopping. "I raced you," called Alfie. "I'm back first, so there." Annie Rose didn't care. She was tired. She sat back in her pushchair and sucked her thumb. Mum put the brake on the pushchair and left Annie Rose at the bottom of the steps while she lifted the basket of shopping up to the top. Then she found a key and opened the front door. Alfie dashed in ahead of her. "I've won, I've won," he shouted. Mum put the shopping down in the hall and went back down the steps to lift Annie Rose out of her pushchair. And what do you think Alfie did then? He gave the door a great big slam, bang, just like that. Then Mum was outside the door holding Annie Rose and Alfie was inside with the shopping. And Mum's key was inside too.
You do not forget, clearly, what it's like to be a child.
This drama did happen not to one of my children, but to some children I knew. And, of course, a picture book has a gutter down the middle. Any book does. And you have to, if you're illustrating, you either flow across it and try and pretend it isn't there, or you make drop-ins on the pages. But in this case, I could actually make the form of the book, the actual physical thing, part of the story. So tiny children, 3, 4 years old, can look at this and they know perfectly well that Mum is on the outside over there and Alfie is inside. I didn't even have to draw the door. All I had to do was to show the catch just a little bit out of his reach. This is the oldest silent movie trick in the book, you know. It's just do the split screen, didn't they? Some of those Marx Brothers films. And it worked brilliantly in this particular case.
Why is it, although do I need to ask that after what you've just said, what do you think makes your books so enduringly popular? Is it that fact that we can all relate to them, the stories?
Well, I do write about real life. I don't do fantasy. And I don't know why. Yes, they all are very much real life, real experience.
There are certain fundamentals of childhood that always remain the same.
Yes, I hope so. I do think, you know, in spite of everything, I think one of the great challenges, as we know, you know, it's about the speed at which they have to react, little children, you know, cross here, red light, quick, you know, do this. And their responses are being hyped up. And I think that's the big problem today, that they've got too much coming at them. These little children, you want to just calm them down, take it slowly, if you can. Go on holiday and don't take the technology with you.
You took your experience of opera rather slowly, didn't you? You were a bit wary of it to begin with.
Oh, yes, yes. I do think it's difficult, actually. I went on a foreign exchange in my teens and I had to endure what seemed like an interminable Wagner opera in French. And it rather put me off. The only advice I can give to anyone who, like me, thinking perhaps opera's expensive to get a ticket, but even listening to it on a record, it's try something of Mozart for the first time. I'd definitely do The Marriage of Figaro.
Yes. It's a perfect opera.
It's a perfect opera, but it's so light, it's so funny, it bells along, it's wonderfully easy to listen to. Thank you.
Voi che sapete, you know what love is, from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. And we heard Joyce Di Donato with the orchestra of Lyon National Opera, conducted by Kazushi Ono. And you can find details of all Shirley Hughes's music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and download hundreds of previous editions of the programme. Now, Shirley, you married your husband, John, in 1952. Yeah. You didn't actually meet in the most romantic of circumstances, did you?
No, but yes, I had a friend who had, after we'd graduated from Oxford, she had fallen pregnant in her last term, and she had the baby, and they married, and she was living in a basement flat, and upstairs, these two dashing architects were sharing the flat above. And we used to see rather glamorous girls being wafted through the hall and music and drinks and nice things happening upstairs. While she was struggling, I used to go around and help her sometimes, struggling with the baby and everything. And one day I went there and she was in tears because it was a basement and the drain was... the water wasn't going away properly. And this terrible smelly gunge was coming up out of the drain. And we didn't know what to do, and it was awful. Down the road came this nice man, John Bonamy, home from work. He nipped down the steps. He took his jacket, turned up his impeccable shirt sleeve, plunged his arm down the drain and unblocked it. And the sun came up, baby stopped crying. I thought, gosh, this is the man for me.
Was he one of the architects upstairs?
Yes, he was one of the architects. Mm. Mm. And we did meet in more romantic circumstances a bit later.
And I imagine, being an architect, that you had a connection in terms of drawing.
Yes, because all our marvellous holidays throughout the whole of our time together, we used to go to Italy. He drew the buildings, of course. He was very good at, he didn't just, and he took photographs, but he didn't just look at a building and think, oh, that's a big Renaissance building, as one does, you know. So he could look at some huge romantic facade and know exactly how it worked and how the actual thing was planned out. So he was looking at the big scene, and I am myopic, really, and I was drawing the corner of somebody's allotment, you know. But we did have a wonderful time.
John died sadly in 2007, after you'd been married for more than half a century. Has work been a solace for you since then? I mean, being able to pour yourself into it.
Yeah. Yes, it's the framework of my life. I go in there every day in the morning because I have a very good light in my workroom at that point, all morning. And I work on in there till I'm tired. I usually work through, you know, a few cuppers in between, but I work through till about one or two, and then I knock off. I never work in the afternoons. And then I knock off, all ready to listen to some music. I can't listen to music when I'm working, of course, the drawing. It has to be complete silence.
But when you're not working, is it a comfort music?
Oh, yes, it is. It is.
I ask that because you've chosen a piece by John's favourite composer, Beethoven, and I wonder how you homed in on the First Symphony in particular.
I think I looked at all the stuff we'd listened to together, and this particular one was one that we'd loved. We used to, when we put the children to bed, we used to sit down and listen to a bit of music when we were tired, and it was wonderfully uplifting and therapeutic, and because he loved Beethoven so much, I was able to get there as well.
Well, going back to the plumbing, that was the beginning of your relationship, and this is the beginning of Beethoven's journey through his 9 symphonies.
Thank you.
Colin Davis conducting the Staatskapelle Dresden in music from the first movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 1. I can't help wondering, talking of your late husband John, Shirley Hughes, whether there's any of him in the cheerful dad in the Alfie books.
I don't know. I guess, yes.
The dad. Subconsciously.
He's very important, the dad, isn't he? Yes, yes. I think that it might be. But it's subconscious.
Yeah, and do your children and grandchildren ever appear, but again, maybe just almost subliminally?
No, I don't draw them at all. I mean, I have drawn them, but they don't come into my books at all. I'm always, you know, is Alfie one of your own children? Not one of my own children or my grandchildren at that age. He's a figment of my imagination.
And you work with your daughter, Clara,
indeed,
who's also an illustrator.
Yes, she is, yes. I don't know what gave her that idea. But
And you still live in the house in West London, which you and John moved into more than 60 years ago. And this piece, I think, takes you back to when your children were growing up there, because they're all quite musical, aren't they?
Yes. As I say, I had a very bad musical education. But what little I know about classical music I've learnt from my children, because they're all terribly interested in music one way or another. And my son Tom played the flute, and he got quite good deal with it, played in school orchestra and so on. And I got a very strong memory of being up and cooking the breakfast in the kitchen and hearing him practice it before school. You know, when you hear people practicing and they go on, and it's just that one bit, they can't get it, and they keep getting it. No, he can't get it. He keeps on going over and over it. And then at last, yes! Wonderful breakthrough. Hooray, you know.
Well, we haven't got him playing here, but we have got a very good flautist, Jean-Pierre Rampal, as you've requested, playing music by Mozart from the Flute Concerto in G major. And this is part of the second movement.
Thank you.
Jean-Pierre Rampal, with music from the second movement of the Mozart Flute Concerto No. 1 in G major. Theodor Guschelbauer was conducting the Vienna Symphony Orchestra. Shirley Hughes, you started writing novels for older children in your 80s, didn't you? And those books, in some ways, I suppose, take you back to your wartime childhood.
Yes, yes, one of them very much so. One set in Nazi-occupied Florence. I did know a family who hid escaping prisoners of war, Allied prisoners of war, from the Nazi occupation. But yes, and the other one is very much about somebody living in, as it were, West Kirby during the war.
And what's that one called?
It's called Whistling in the Dark, because, of course, it relates to the blackout.
Do you ever contemplate retirement, or are you just as full of ideas as ever?
Oh, no, I don't really. I'm working on another Alfie book at the moment, which is very demanding, Alfie going to nursery school. And I've got some more coming up, yes. Fingers crossed.
Well, given that you were brought up near Liverpool, I think perhaps your final choice is not so surprising.
Well, yes, my final choice, of course, is... it's the Beatles. They, of course, hit us when my children were young, and we were all madly keen and singing, yeah, 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 and being very excited about the Beatles. But
and, of course, they tell stories very much in their songs, don't they?
You're right. Absolutely. They're very good at narrative songs. And most pop singers at the time sang in a sort of fake American voice. Of course, they sing in the vernacular, the Scouse accent. Mm. I love the skill of, they can sometimes tell a whole story in one of their songs. And this one, She's Leaving Home, is really, it's all about a girl creeping down, leaving a note which she hoped would say more, you know, early in the morning, going off to meet a man in the motor trade. Oh, dear. Heart sinks. And I think McCartney was only in his early 20s when he wrote that song. And I don't, it's terribly good the way he identifies with the young person, of course, but he also identifies with Mum in her curlers, you know. He was a very good songwriter.
Yeah. No, they made an extraordinary pair, didn't they, Lennon
yes.
and McCartney?
Yes, yes.
Well, may I wish you a very happy 90th birthday, since this is the year, yes. And thank you for sharing your passions for drawing, writing and music, Shirley Hughes.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching her handkerchief. Quietly turning the back door key, stepping outside, she is free. She, we gave her most of our lives, is leaving, sacrificed most of our lives. We gave her everything money could buy.
She's
snores as his wife gets into a dressing gown, picks up the letter that's lying there, standing alone at the top of the stairs. She breaks down and cries to her husband, Daddy, our baby's gone. Why would she treat us so thoughtlessly? How could she do this to me?
She,
we
struggle hard all our lives to get by. She's leaving home after living alone for so many years. Friday morning at 9 o'clock, she is far away, waiting to keep the appointment she made, meeting a man from the motor trade. She, what did we do that was wrong?
He's happy.
We didn't know it was wrong.
The Beatles with She's Leaving Home, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the late Shirley Hughes, who died in February. That programme was originally broadcast in 2017. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. You'll find details of the music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds. And the programme returns next Sunday at midday, when we'll hear Michael Barclay in conversation with the doctor and charity founder, Waheed Aryan.
The BBC Proms 2022, the world's greatest classical music festival, restored to its full 8-week glory at the Royal Albert Hall. With more proms than ever before across the UK, from Belfast to Truro. And the return of international orchestras from Berlin, Vienna, the United States and Australia. With incredible music and world-renowned artists, there is something for everyone. Start planning your perfect summer of music with the 2022 Proms Guide, available now. Go to the BBC Proms website to find out more.
And now the news at 1 o'clock. The Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis says he'll urge political parties at Stormont to form a government when he meets their leaders in Belfast tomorrow. The Nationalist Party Sinn Féin won the most seats in the Assembly election, but the Democratic Unionists have refused to work with them until post-Brexit trade rules are changed. Mr Lewis acknowledged there were issues to resolve with the European Union. The Shadow Levelling Up Secretary, Lisa Nandy, has said she believes Sir Keir Starmer's character shows he's not a rule-breaker. Police are investigating the Labour leader after he was seen drinking beer in an MP's office on the campaign trail last April. Most indoor socialising was banned at that time. The Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab has accused Sir Keir of rank double standards. More than 60 people are feared dead after a Russian bomb hit a school in the Donbass area of Ukraine. The governor of the Luhansk region says residents were sheltering in the basement. Ukrainian fighters who were holed up inside a steel plant in the Russian-occupied city of Mariupol have been giving a rare online news conference. The deputy commander of the regiment said Russian forces were trying to storm the site. He said he couldn't confirm whether all civilians had been evacuated from the factory, as was reported yesterday. On to the weather forecast. A mixture of sunny spells and patchy cloud across the country. A few isolated showers developing in the north and the southwest. Dry and bright for most of us. Top temperatures of 19 in Cardiff, 18 Celsius in London, 17 degrees in both Edinburgh and Belfast. And that's the BBC News. It's 1:02.
Ralph Vaughan Williams. Where will he take us? To mark his 150th anniversary, the InTune mixtape takes you on 5 musical journeys inspired by one of our nation's favourite composers. We range far and wide with Vaughan Williams on the InTune mixtape. On Monday to Friday evenings at 7 p.m.